is Frederick Focus. News Radio 930 WFMD talks to newsmakers throughout mid-Maryland with your host, Ryan Hedrick.
And Happy New Year. It is 2022 right here at WFMD and WFRE. And this is the Frederick Focus Show. Now, usually we talk to newsmakers and we deal with local issues, both political and socioeconomic, but I thought we'd use this first episode, this first year, 2022, to kind of look back at the year that was 2021. We're going to deal with a multitude of local issues today and visit with some former guests as we kind of reflect back on some of the guests we had, like Chief Equity and Inclusion Officer Michael Hughes, who's in charge of diversity here in Frederick County, a very controversial subject to say the least, because when County Executive Jan Gardner brought Michael Hughes in, it was a big salary, a six-figure salary, and he's kind of in charge of overseeing that Frederick County remains equitable, fair, and diverse for businesses and citizens. We're also going to talk to Maryland Delegate Ken Kerr. As Ken Kerr talks about police reform, we'll talk to Alderman Donna Kazemchek, Frederick City Alderman Donna Kazemchek, about the sexual harassment controversy with a former alderman, Roger Wilson, and how that plagued the election. And we're also going to visit with Frederick County Sheriff Chuck Jenkins to talk about gang activity in Frederick County. So lots to get into right here on the Frederick Focus Show. And we lead off with the Diversity and Inclusion Officer, Michael Hughes, who made his way from North Carolina. Nobody knew who Michael Hughes was when he was hired as the Diversity and Inclusion Officer. And furthermore, Frederick County did not have such a position. It was actually created during the pandemic. So I asked Michael Hughes in one of our visits in 2021, what was it about diversity and inclusion that he thinks Frederick County residents can learn? You're listening to the best of Frederick Focus as we recap 2021, a very busy news year for sure, right here on WFMD and WFRE. Happy New Year.
We've been so limited too often in our exposure. We work with people from different cultures, different ethnicities, different backgrounds, different races. And, you know, that usually goes well. And we work well together. And usually doesn't feel like there's too many issues around that. And that's good. But I think what we're missing so often is real relationships. In other words, relationships that go beyond what we do at work together. And we go to lunch together. And we enjoy each other's company. We like each other. And we respect each other. And that's good. But do we go to each other's picnics? In other words, really get into somebody's culture. Do something crazy like this. And I haven't done it myself. Get your hair cut at their barbershop. In other words, hang out with, you know, in the case of this, I'm thinking of men maybe. You know, barbershop talk and the things that happen. Because, you know, that's what culture's happening. Spend time within that culture. And, you know, go to church with folks. Not just one time, but say for the next 2 months, I'm going to go to this church 8 straight times or whatever it might be. Really get a feel for the culture. Because that person that we work with, we get work. We get them at work. But to understand somebody, you understand their lives outside of, you know, our work time together. So really spending time with one another, you know, cookouts and churches and other things that are really a part of their, that make them who they are. And we don't know them that way if we don't spend time with, because they don't, they may come in and tell you we had a picnic or, you know, had a cookout, had a lot of people there, had a good time. But you don't get it until you've been there. Now, the benefit I think that most, or many at least, African Americans have had is our culture has been centered around white culture. So most African Americans kind of have that experience. You know, they kind of have one foot in that world, one foot in this world. But my white friends don't always have that same experience, at least to much degree. You know, so if we can find ways to really spend time with one another's culture, you know, so it's not just the individual, because that individual is a product of their culture. And if we can do that, I think that'll give us a great deal of exposure. Then we'll know what we don't know.
There was a councilwoman here in Frederick County that basically said over the summer that she was racist, that she felt that white people were racist. There's a lot of
emotional reaction over the summer because of BLM and people feeling certain ways that they'd never felt. But how prevalent is the type of racism that she was alluding to? I think she was alluding to systemic racism. Take us inside that world. It's complex for some people to understand, but how prevalent and woven into our everyday fabric is systemic racism?
Well, that's a very important question. And me, of course, being the person that loves history, I kind of want to go back and think about it historically. Because sometimes when folks will ask me, does systemic racism exist? And I kind of want to walk them through and then help them to maybe answer the question for themselves. Because I think if we go back to from the beginning in this country, even before we were the United States as a country, when Europeans first met the indigenous people, very soon after that, race became an issue. And systems and contracts began to be created. And these contracts were written up by a society that was a written society, not an oral culture, more of a written culture. And so white folks would write contracts and folks that weren't used to that style of communication, those types of agreements, might often quite sign these things, not understanding what they're signing. You know, so these are the beginnings of, that's a system, a legal system is what you have there. So from the very beginning, we started with building systems that were inequitable and unfair and systematically designed for one group to win over another. And then, of course, slavery is not just someone that owns 5-6 slaves or 30 or 40 slaves, but it was a system. This was supported by the government. And when a slave ran away, they had the Fugitive Slave Act in place. So laws were passed. Laws said, what you could do with a slave, how to sell a slave. After the Nat Turner Rebellion, there was concern about slaves being sold out of Virginia. So laws began to be passed in certain states so you couldn't buy a slave from Virginia. You know, so systems have always been in place. And so then slavery ends, and you would think, well, you would want to think that that would just end it all. But, of course, it didn't. And so even though that system ended, other systems end up being developed, and we would call those ultimately referred to as Jim Crow systems. And so those systems were in place, and they were in place in my lifetime. You know, I was born in the mid-60s, or early 60s, really. And so the systems were in place then. And, of course, President Lyndon Johnson signed legislation, which really shouldn't have been needed because we had legislation. If it had been followed all along, would have made that legislation unnecessary, but it wasn't. So, because the system finds a way to adapt itself so often. And so laws were passed, and you would have thought that we would have been seeing equitable outcomes by within the 10 years or 15 years or so. Well, it gets to be 1980, and it's better, but it's not there yet. We look at disparities.
And that is Michael Hughes right here on the Frederick Focus Show on 930 WFMD and WFRE. You're listening to the best of the program from 2021. And I'll tell you, there were a lot of intriguing interviews that I did during the course of the show. And, you know, during the course of the show, I tried to get perspective from both sides because, as you know, sometimes the media can become a slanted version of itself. We could focus too much on the left and too much on the right when it comes to politics, but I really prided myself on reaching out to different parties, different ideologies, and making everybody feel welcomed and making everybody feel like they had a voice. And one of the voices that appeared that may have a different political take than myself is Frederick Alderman Donna Kazemchek, who announced that she would be running for her last term. She has served for about 20 years. There was a controversy in the Democrat Party where there was one alderman that accused Roger Wilson of sexual harassment that was found to be unfounded at the time. I mean, attorneys brought out paperwork and they basically
decided that they weren't going to pursue any charges. There was never charges any brought to Roger Wilson. But nevertheless, it may have affected the Frederick election. So we had Donna Kazemchek on after the accusations, which came last December. So here was her reaction to those accusations in her own party. Right here, you're listening to the best of the Frederick Focus Show. You're listening to 930 WFMD and WFRE.
Well, I don't think any of us can make complete sense of any of it, because I think that Alderman McShane was in a position that is very difficult to be in. I believe that he is telling the complete truth, and that people came to him, and that the fact is we have no way to make those complaints against elected officials in the city of Frederick, which is why I requested a change to our ethics ordinance. We're amending our ethics ordinance to ensure that elected officials can, there is a way to bring complaints like that forward. But I certainly understand Alderman McShane's frustrations and why he did what he did. Doesn't mean I agree with the way he did it, but I understand his frustration. As for the controversy itself, as long as both Alderman Wilson and Alderman McShane behave civilly in our public meetings and through our public discourse, that's going to play out however it's going to play out. And I think that there's probably some stuff going to happen in the next couple of months that may surprise people.
Are you concerned that there may be victims out there? I mean, we're talking about sexual harassment. Now, we see it's happening at the national level and in New York, and I'm not trying to compare Roger Wilson to Andrew Cuomo, but I am saying that the two incidents are related, alleged incidents are related, because there may be victims out there, and obviously we need to pay close attention to that. Are you concerned that there may be women that he was inappropriate with?
So I'm not going to go to that. Am I concerned about women that Alderman Wilson? I'm not going to go directly to that. I'm going to say that I'm obviously concerned that there's not a process that women or men have to report a complaint against an elected official. And so I am concerned that there may be victims out there, whether of any sitting elected official, who have no way to have their stories heard in a private setting, that they're not re-victimized. That's always the issue. The victims.
Well, that's Donna Kazemchek, the Frederick alderman, and she's talking about the controversy between Ben McShane and Roger Wilson. Ben McShane accusing Roger Wilson of sexual assault on Facebook last December. And of course, that was one of our big news stories of 2021. You're listening to the best of Frederick Focus. So far, we've talked to Michael Hughes, Donna Kazemchek. Coming up next is Ken Kerr, Maryland Delegate Ken Kerr, who really was an outspoken critic, and he talked up and spoke out about police reform. Of course, police reform was big after the Derek Chauvin and George Floyd case, and we talked to him about what it means and about why people are going after police. Was there a mental health aspect that we weren't looking at when it came to what people were doing with police attacking police? Remember last summer how bad it was? It was one of the biggest stories of the year in 2021, and of course the election kind of perpetuated all that. But let's talk to Maryland Delegate Ken Kerr right here on the best of the Frederick Focus Show.
Well, as you said, mental health is a big aspect of it. Too often, police will arrive at the scene where someone's in a mental health crisis. And so what we really do need to do, and I think everyone's in agreement is that we need to focus a bit more on police training, first of all, to recognize when someone is suffering from a mental, a psychological episode versus someone who has criminal intent. That's one aspect. The other, another big sticking point seems to be the use of the no-knock warrant, where the House had a version that said they can, well, right now I think we're talking about they can only be used during daylight hours. And if you're going to use a no-knock warrant outside of the daylight hours, then you have to demonstrate that there's someone's in imminent physical danger. The other thing with the warrants is that rather than announcing yourself and breaking the door down, you have to give the people who are being served the warrant a reasonable amount of time to come and answer the door or to respond. At one point, it was 30 seconds, and I think we've compromised now on 20 seconds with the Senate. Another thing is the use of force. When the use of force is justified, those parameters are being argued back and forth right now.
So 30 seconds for a police officer, and I'm not a cop, and you're not a cop, respectfully, Delegate Kerr, but 30 seconds when you're pounding on a door and you suspect that there may be a lot of drugs or a lot of weapons in a home of a suspect you're searching for would seem like an awfully long time to me, especially when you're adrenaline's going. Have you heard proponents say that that might be too much time, 30 seconds for a no-knock warrant?
Yeah, that's what the counter argument is. So that's why we're trying to find out what is a reasonable amount of time that would protect the safety of the police officers and also respect the rights of someone who may be incorrectly served with a warrant. You know, we've had situations right in Frederick County where a warrant's been served on the wrong property, and at one point it resulted in the shooting of a dog. Up in the northern part of the county. So mistakes are made when these warrants are served, and sometimes they're served on the wrong people. So, you know, it would be nice to give someone who's being wrongly served with a warrant an opportunity to respond and say, no, you're looking for the guy next door, not me. So, is the appropriate thing, and that's why we have these debates back and forth to try and arrive at balancing the safety of the officers and the rights of the citizens.
Delegate Ken Kerr joining us on the Frederick Focus Show, and we're so grateful that he has chosen to join us and talk about the issues. This particular session, Delegate, I'm quite sure that you weren't anticipating, at least before last summer, of talking about police reform. Are you surprised about how this session has gone? Because we have some very, very serious things happening around the country that have had a trickle-down impact to Maryland, like police reform, like COVID. I mean, this, in my mind, and I'd love to get your take on it, is an unprecedented session with unusual things going on.
It has been more difficult than usual. It seems as if we are working almost constantly this time because it's, you know, it's easy at the last minute to call a Zoom hearing. And we've had, in some ways, a whole lot more public participation. Actually, yesterday we had a bill hearing, and one of the witnesses was calling in from Hawaii. Now, he wouldn't have been able to testify in a normal year because people have to show up in person unless they want to send an email or write a letter. But so we've had more participation along those lines, but less participation in that so much of what happens here is informal. Someone will stop by the office if they have 5 minutes to talk to you, or as you're walking from the office building to the state house, people will walk with you and share their concerns, and all that aspect is gone this year. It's made the work much more difficult because when we have our own legislation, sometimes it'll get stuck in a committee and we'll need to know what we need to do to get the legislation moved. But we can't just walk up to the subcommittee chairman on the floor before the session starts and have a little conversation.
And certainly an interesting session that was last year, as they come up on a new session, we're days away from the start of a new session. You're listening to the best of the Frederick Focus Show, and we save Sheriff Chuck Jenkins for last as Sheriff Jenkins weighing in about gang violence in Frederick County and just how prevalent gangs are in Frederick County. Again, you're listening to the best of the Frederick Focus Show right here on 930 WFMD and WFRE.
We've seen, we've got a significant number of MS-13 gang members here locally. We also have, and I'm just going to talk about, so let's talk about the gangs. So there are dozens and dozens of criminal gangs in Frederick with hundreds and hundreds of members. So if we talk about the African-American gangs, you have the Crips, the Bloods, a number of subsets of each of those located throughout the city and certain areas of Frederick County. You have the outlaw motorcycle gangs who do exist here in Frederick County. You've got the Latino gangs, which include MS-13, the Latin Kings, 18th Street, Sinaloan cartel offshoots. So you've got those gangs here in Frederick County. They've been here for a while. Again, I go back to what I'm faulted for, the 287G program. Through that program, we have arrested and deported out of this county roughly probably 110 to 115 criminal gang members out of the 1,600 and some odd criminals that we've deported. So it's been, again, it's a public safety program that benefits this county.
Does it go back to we're a target-rich environment with money to spend, or is it more complex than that? Because when you're telling me that we have Crips and Bloods here in 18th Street and Latin Kings and outlaw motorcycle clubs, I mean, I'm in shock.
Don't be. It does go to more than just we're an affluent county. It goes to these gangs have come in here. The element has set up shop here in Frederick County. It's all about drug trafficking, prostitution in some cases, gun trafficking in some cases. These organized groups and gangs who have just developed to become criminal enterprises. Mm-hmm. And the only thing we can do is go after, and we can't go after someone just because they're a gang member. It's all about the crimes they commit as gang members.
You know, sometimes I look at a city like Hagerstown, which is a ripe target for Baltimore criminals who may get out of the prison there and go to the homeless shelter and set up shop and sell crack cocaine on Jonathan Street. But how much did that criminal element in Baltimore's infiltrated Frederick and cause problems for you?
Quite a bit over the years, and especially when you talk about the flow of drugs. The flow of drugs in this area comes directly from Baltimore in most cases. Coming through and into Frederick County comes from Baltimore. As a matter of fact, our young people here in Frederick County travel to Baltimore to buy their heroin on the street and bring it back to Frederick County.
It's certainly disturbing, and you're right about the tragic number of overdoses that we've suffered. We've lost some great kids to some really bad drugs over the years. Talking to Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, I want to get into your support of the Second Amendment. For people that aren't familiar with the state's gun laws, what's wrong with Maryland's gun laws, and what would you like to see changed?
Well, unfortunately, in Maryland, I think they're far too restrictive and prohibitive. They keep coming up with these laws that they think is going to reduce crime. The laws, in fact, have had no effect at all on reduction in crime. I think they're far too restrictive. I'm a believer in this. I'm a believer in every individual has a right to protect themselves every place they have a legal right to be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm a proponent in concealed carry. I'm a proponent in citizens having the right to carry a firearm to protect themselves. Unfortunately, in the state of Maryland, they don't have that right. You have to have a good and substantial reason. I don't agree with it, but that's the way the law is in Maryland.
So what is a good and substantial reason? Not in the eyes of Chuck Jenkins, but in the eyes of the law.
Okay. The way the law is right
yes.
now. So typically in layperson's terms, it would be, if you're an individual and you are in a business or own a business and you carry proceeds and make deposits, cash deposits at banks on a routine basis, you will probably be granted permission to have a carry permit, or if you've been in a position to have your life threatened. If you're living under some threat or have had a threat made on your life, you would probably be approved to have a carry permit. And typically that's about the limits of what you can get.
Do you see that getting any better? Is the the bureaucracy in Annapolis too thick for it to change?
As long as we are controlled by a Democratic legislature, it will never change. What I would like to see is that the sheriffs be granted the authority to issue a permit in their county. Because who better knows the population than a sheriff? Who knows their constituents better than a county sheriff?
And that's a great point by Frederick County Sheriff Chuck Jenkins, one of our favorite guests of 2021. You've been listening to the best of the Frederick Focus Show 2021. Have a marvelous 2022. We'll talk to you soon.
Frederick Focus has been a public service of News Radio 930 WFMD.